80 years ago this week, FDR uttered the famous rallying cry to a nation, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Yet, as Ira Katznelson documents in his new history, Fear Itself, that statement was far more than poetic rhetoric. Fear would be the defining force in the decades following the Wall Street crash, threatening and reshaping our fragile democracy. In a work that, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy, deeply reconceptualizes the New Deal, Katznelson defines the contours of the fear, outward and inward, which placed the Republic in peril. Framed in global terms, he argues the passing of the New Deal legislation was no less radical a move than the French Revolution. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ira Katznelson to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ira is Columbia University's Ruggles Professor of Political Science and History, President of the Social Science Research Council, and Research Associate at Cambridge University Center for History and Economics. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. The book, Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. As I stated in the introduction, that word fear, that this would be the defining force for decades following the New Deal. What was it that you wanted to explore and as David Kennedy said, to reconceptualize what we know and what we think about the New Deal?
Well, begin with fear itself. When Roosevelt spoke those famous words at the inauguration, he cautioned us not to fear. But in fact, the American people faced unremitting fear during the 1930s and 1940s. The collapse of capitalism, the competition from mass dictatorships, Nazi, Soviet, fascist, unprecedented violence during the Second World War, culminating in atomic weapons and the discovery of the Holocaust, followed by the Cold War. And that layering of fear provided a context and a motivation for action at a time of great peril and danger. The enormous triumph of the New Deal was that it confronted major problems under conditions of fear, keeping our constitutional system intact.
Now, the thing, you're basically looking at a 20, 21-year period here from this to the up until the Cold War.
From the inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt to the inauguration of Dwight Eisenhower in 1953.
The fears themselves, and one of the fears, and we'll go through these, but as you write in the book, because you look at pretty much every piece of House and Senate legislation over this period and look at the fears that pervaded us as a nation. One of them, of course, was warfare and violence, and that it was going out of control.
The period of the 1930s and 1940s was the moment when what we now call the national security state was fashioned, and fashioned under conditions of emergency. We often think that the security state began during and after the Second World War, but it already began to take shape before the war. President Roosevelt twice declared states of emergency, 1939 and 1941, before the United States was at war. And by the end of the decade of the 1940s, the Congress had created virtually all the institutions with which we're now familiar in a national security state. Joint Chiefs of Staff, National Security Council in the White House, the Central Intelligence Agency, and so on. And the great feature of those developments was a separation of national security politics and policy from what might be called normal politics and policy, with less control by Congress, with more secrecy, with fewer procedures, as the United States pursued the protection of democracy on a global scale.
What was the concern about liberal democracies, ultimately, that they would succumb to dictatorship?
Ultimately, this was a period, we should recall, of the toppling of democracies. At the end of the First World War, the United States, famously uttered by Woodrow Wilson's claim that this was an era of democracy, at the end of the First World War, we expected democracy to thrive globally. But by the middle and late 1930s, the great majority of the world's democracies had toppled, most famously Weimar Germany producing Nazi Germany. And on the eve of Roosevelt's inauguration, he was cautioned by many Americans, including the country's leading journalist, Walter Lippmann, that unless the United States itself suspended some of its constitutional rules, we would not be able to confront the emergency. And yet, the United States did confront the emergency without suspending its constitution, keeping Congress intact, but with a great irony attached to that, namely that the success of the New Deal hinged on the support of the least liberal part of the Democratic Party coalition, the American Jim Crow South.
You talk about in the book that it's something that you call a Southern cage, that ultimately American liberal democracy was given the space within which to proceed was restricted by this Southern cage because of this deal that was struck with those conservative Southern lawmakers. So it was ultimately, I guess, by trying to address that third fear, was all trying to look for support to combat the first two, right?
This was the greatest irony of the period. There were 17 states in the Union at the time that practiced mandatory racial segregation. These were the same states that had chattel slavery, racial slavery, before the Civil War. And this part of the racial order in America was virtually all Democratic. By 1940, there were 34 United States senators from the South. But after 1938, the majority of Democrats in the House were Southern. And in consequence, key legislative decisions had to pass through the approval of Southern members of Congress who wished above all to protect their racial order and the autonomy of the South in dealing with race. And some of the very best features of the New Deal era and some of the worst features of the New Deal era depended on decisions taken by Southern members of Congress, for without their approval, nothing could have passed.
Did they realize their power, the Southern lawmakers?
Oh, indeed they did. The majority of leaders of key committees, leaders of Congress, majority leaders, speakers of the House were Southern, and they were enormously self-conscious. Here's just one example. In 1944, with more than 10 million Americans under arms, the question arose as to how soldiers should vote. Now, the election of 44 took place after D-Day. We had soldiers in the field. They could not write for absentee ballots. The administration proposed that every soldier be handed a federal ballot to write the name of the preferred candidate, Dewey or Roosevelt. But the bill that passed Congress was the bill authored by James Eastland of Mississippi in the Senate and John Rankin in the House. And Eastland got up to defend his bill by saying, and this is an exact quote, "Our boys are fighting for white supremacy." And that bill left it to the states to accept the federal ballot, which meant that the Southern states could continue to exclude African Americans from voting, even if they were fighting in the field in Europe.
When you examine this, and I guess for you personally, what were you surprised about of how contradictory this was to the legacy of the New Deal?
Well, the single biggest surprise I had concerned the role of the South in leading the United States to oppose Nazism in the late 1930s and early 1940s. In 1941, President Roosevelt requested the renewal of the peacetime draft. This was some 6 months before Pearl Harbor. And when he made that request, we had a draft 1 year old that had many restrictions. Soldiers could not leave the Western Hemisphere, and it was just for a year. The renewal was voted in the House 203 to 202. Republican Party, mostly isolationist, voted no. Many Northern Democrats who had German, Italian, and Irish constituents voted no. And only with a unanimous Southern wing did that bill pass by one vote. If not for that legislation, the United States would have had an army smaller than that of Belgium when Pearl Harbor had hit. And I had not quite thought in advance of writing the book about the role the South played, this ironic role, in fighting the world's largest racist largest racist country in Europe, Nazi Germany, on behalf of principles and views which it held precious in the American South.
The subtitle, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time, and of course those origins, I mean, we're still very much feeling the effects today.
We are indeed. By 1952, the United States had developed a new state in Washington with, as it were, two faces. One, a domestic state, which was an interest group state, a state of competition between different interests, labor and business, North and South, men and women, without any advanced sense of public interest. The public interest was the outcome of interest group and congressional struggles. And the other face of the new national state was that of global state, in which there were very strong principles for democracy, against dictatorship, but very few sets of limits or procedures. And we continue to live under the auspices of that two-sided national state. It has many advantages, and it also has potential and actual pathologies. We worry about money in politics. We worry about narrow interests and the lack of public-spiritedness in the Congress and elsewhere. We worry about polarization. We worry about the absence of ability to govern. And at the same time, we also worry about the use of drones. We worry about secrecy in the CIA, headline news just yesterday in the confirmation of Mr. Brennan. So the issues established under conditions of fear within the national government by the end of the New Deal era continue to define and sometimes haunt us today as we continue, alas, to live in an age of fear.
The name of the book is Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. Ira Katznelson, I thank you very much for joining us this morning and sharing your expertise. An honor. Thank you.
Thank you indeed for having me.
Great pleasure. Again, the name of the book, Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. It's published by LiveRight. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.